We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Audacy put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Audacy. Visit ads.audacy.com.
He swings! Alexander Steen on his forehand, hits a deep to left field! That's way back! Shoots! Score! And it's a bummer! Bring out the Zamboni!
Oh, yeah!
This is a legendary KMOX Sports Open Line, presented by Dave Sinclair, Lincoln and Ford, celebrating over 50 years serving St. Louis on America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
Welcome in. It is the Dave Sinclair, Lincoln and Ford Sports Open Line. Chris Raby with you on KMOX, a Thursday, the August 2nd, 2018 edition of the program. Happy to be with you until 9 o'clock tonight. A huge Cardinals win over the Rockies as they come from behind to walk them off and win the series 3 out of 4 games, a 5-2 homestand. First time the Cardinals have won back-to-back series since the first week of May. Believe it or not, they went 5-0 against the Cubs and the White Sox. I guess the order was the White Sox, then the Cubs. But they come from behind today, scored twice in the bottom of the ninth off of Wade Davis, and beat the Rockies 3-2. They go 5-2 on the homestand. They're 56-53. Still some work to be done, but they are 4 games out currently for the second wild card spot in the National League. So an impressive performance today. I think that two things really stand out over the last 2 days. It's all about opportunity, and we'll get to that in a second. Here's what we've got coming up for you. Going to talk a little bit of golf right off the bat here at 6:30. Dan Reardon and Nick Price. We are a week away from recapping first round play, the PGA Championship at Belle Reve. Was watching the Bridgestone today, and was watching the incredible field that is playing at Firestone right now and is going to be playing here in St. Louis next week. Getting really, really excited. And we're going to talk some golf and hear from Dan Reardon and Nick Price coming up at 6:30. From 7 until 9, it's all baseball. It's the Strike Zone powered by Graybar. I'm going to be joined by Charlie Marlowe of Fox 2 in studio over here at Busch Stadium to talk about this past week. Because when we talked last week with Benjamin Hockman, we were wondering what the trade deadline would hold in store for this club, where they would go, what they would look like, what changes they would make, and boy, have there been a bunch of them. From DFAing Greg Holland and Tyler Lyons and putting Brett Cease on the 10-day disabled list last Friday in order to recall Daniel Ponce de Leon, Tyler Webb, and purchase the contract of Dakota Hudson, to then winning 2 of 3 against the Cubs over the weekend, the Saturday night trade of Luke Voit to the New York Yankees, and then the trade of Tommy Pham to the Tampa Bay Rays before the deadline on Tuesday. Just a lot has happened, and opportunity has been what has been created. Opportunity for young pitching in the bullpen, a bullpen that has shined, and a bullpen that over the last 2 games in winning games 3 and 4 of the series against the Rockies, through 8 1/3 innings, 2 hits, 1 run, opportunity for Harrison Bader, who last night went 3 for 4 with a double, 2 runs scored, a stolen base, who today started and really catalyzed the Cardinals' rally in the 9th inning by getting a base hit, moving Greg Garcia to third, then stealing second, scoring the game-winning run. Tyler O'Neill, who made 2 dazzling catches in the outfield today. Opportunity, opportunity, opportunity. It's what the Cardinals have had. Let's listen into how that 9th inning unfolded.
We're now in the bottom of the 9th. Nobody on, 1 out, 1-1 pitch from Wade Davis headed in. Little fly ball to base hit in the left field. Tying runners aboard. Here come your Redbird. And it brings in Bader. Bader could send us all home. Man at first, 1 out, 2-1 pitch. Davis 2, Bader. Here it is. Little another into the right field corner. That could put runners at second and third, but Bader's going to stop at first base, and it's first and third. Tying run and scoring position at third base. The pitch 2. Martinez, the runner goes. The throw to second base is high, and he's safe there. So the potential go-ahead run now is in the scoring position.
That's 11 stolen bases for Bader.
Second and third, tying run at third base. It's a 2-1 Rocky lead. Jose Martinez at the plate, and the 1-2 pitch. Swing and a line drive to right field. Cardinals win this one on a base hit by Martinez, a walk-off hit. In to score Bader, and the Redbirds win it 3-2. Three hits in a row, and that's it. Quickly, the game sneaks away from the Rockies, and it goes to the Cardinals.
So last night, a huge night for Harrison Bader. Tonight, a huge finish for Harrison Bader. Last night, Luke Weaver, 2 2/3. The bullpen comes in and saves the day. Tonight, Miles Michaelis goes 7 innings, giving up 2 runs, one of them earned, and the bullpen 2 scoreless in the 8th and 9th to keep it a 1-run game. Just opportunity. And for Harrison Bader, who had struck out 3 times in the game, who stranded the bases loaded in the 6th, then to come through with a hit, with a stolen base, scoring the winning run is Jose Martinez. Speaking of opportunity, he's been coming off the bench. And to do it and deliver, Cardinals manager Mike Schilt after the win and after Harrison Bader, the hero.
This is what Harrison demonstrated yesterday. You know, tough at bat, 2 strikes, battled, demonstrated today. You know, he makes adjustments. That's what we always ask all our players to do, especially important for a younger player. But outstanding job on his part, you know, to just to have a good approach, stay with it, just take what the game gives you.
Was the stolen base call from the dugout, or was that him picking up on Davis?
A combination. I mean, we have some good communication going on right now.
Do you see any lack of confidence in him after striking out 3 times in those situations?
I've never seen a lack of confidence in Harrison Bader. Mm-hmm. One thing I always appreciated when he got to AAA is here's a guy that it was a trait that it's really hard to teach. He's got Joe Torre already said it about Derek Jeter. I'm not comparing the players. I'm just making the analogy. I don't compare players, but he's got inner conceit. You know, he believes in himself, and that's a great trait. And Harrison has always confidently played, knowing he's got ability. And when you struggle, and we talk about that too, remember you've got the ability. But Harrison's a good player.
Was strikeouts all on sliders?
I believe so. I can't say that completely. You might have a better idea. It looked like it. Yeah, that's a heck of a play. You saw some really, really good defense on both sides of the baseball today, and that's a lights out couple of plays this young man's made, and you know, saved some outs and potentially some runs. So great job there. You know, the sack fly, great at bat there as well, and just playing the game right. You know, a lot of skill sets.
Does his approach look different this time around than as when he's been called up before?
I think after, you know, it's his third time, right? So I think the second time up, you start to see a more consistent approach and a little better understanding of game plan. I think he even maybe mentioned that. So I think he's just kind of building off of what that looks like. I think he's had a good plan for some period of time now.
How difficult for a guy like Greg Garcia, his role,
great job by Greg Garcia. I mean, that's a professional bat. That's what Greg Garcia does. He does the little things. And one thing, you know, got that inning started. You know, Arenado makes a really difficult play look somewhat routine, I guess, with Munoz to start the inning off. And then Greg works the count a little bit and just has a nice approach. And he started that inning off. You think about that 9th inning, you got a guy that's been a pretty good closer, obviously, for those guys. And good approach. You know, base hit the other way. Bader, base hit the other way. Martinez, you know, drives the ball in the gap the other way. So, but Greg Garcia is a professional player. Winning player, always has been.
As much as you had to use the bullpen this week, and obviously you needed Miles today, how important was it that he had that many innings and had that good start?
That was huge. That was huge. You know, we had some limitations in the bullpen today, and you know, he's a guy that's been our all-star performer this year, and took the ball on a you know, not a blistering hot day, but took a you know, warmer day and went out, competed well, and I thought he actually, you know, the 2 runs, I mean, the one, you know, kind of a little bit of his own making, but trying to make a play. Always want guys to try to make plays, but, you know, he's on the bases, no excuse for that, but on the bases before that inning, comes back out, but holds him at 2, gets through it and was getting better as the game went, and you know, got us through seven with a little bit shorter pin. So tremendous job by Miles.
When he takes off from second to third in that wild pitch to be in a position to score there, I mean, are you surprised to see him get busted like that with that
ball? I would hope not. You know, I would, you know, we're encouraging these guys to be athletes, and clearly, you know, the pitchers we don't push as hard, but we do expect them to play the game. And you know, our base coaches, Marmol and you know Cheo, do a good job of Kendo over third, keeping those guys engaged appropriately to be ready to you know see something that's there. So really heads up play, got us a run, helped him, helped us.
What does it say about Jose, you know, not getting as much playing time as he had earlier this season to come through in a spot like that against Davis?
It says he's a, you know, just a, I mean, for me, it's, I mean, it's a great teammate, right? I mean, that's probably one of the best compliments I can give Jose. He's, you know, he's still getting opportunities. He's not getting quite as many, but he's determined to make the most of them. And he showed up ready to take a really quality at bat and with a nice plan. And, you know, I think he feels pretty good about it.
Stolen base with the young that got reviewed and changed. Were you close to going out to discuss that situation with Joe West, or did they offer a discussion to you on that or an explanation?
Yeah, I don't think I'm going out and talking to Joe. I mean, I think he'd tell me just to, you know, hey, got you, buddy. and he may not, but there's no point really in it. I mean, I was in the fall league at the conception in 2013 when they started replay in the Arizona fall league and went through that process. So pretty familiar with it. You know, it's morphed over the time, but you know, once they go to a crew chief challenge, no different than earlier. He made the decision, they overturned it. He's got some toe discomfort, and he's going to be day-to-day. We don't expect to be anything that's lingering, but it's something that, you know, just kind of aggravating him a little bit, and we'll evaluate it and see what it looks like tomorrow.
All right, there Mike Schilt talking about Marcell Ozuna, who left the game day-to-day with the toe, but I thought great stuff talking about Miles Michaelis, bridging the gap after the bullpen was so necessary yesterday for 6 1/3 innings, and then talking about the contributions of not just the bullpen, but Harrison Bader and Tyler O'Neill. Opportunity, opportunity, opportunity when the Cardinals delivered on that today. Really impressive win. And again, got to start somewhere, right? Three games above 500. I know that you are still, you know, climbing uphill. There are still teams that you need to pass. But, you know, to win back-to-back series for the first time since the first week of May, and to do it against the Cubs and Rockies, and now set up the next month with teams that you're chasing, huge. We'll talk about it with Charlie Marlow from 7 until 9. Quick break, little golf talk to cleanse the palate before 2 hours of baseball. To Dave Sinclair, Lincoln, and Ford Sports Up 9. Chris Raby with you. Ben Boyd, our executive producer. Mike Anderson's my guy back in the KMOX studios, and we are back after this on KMOX.
I'm supposed to be the franchise player, and we're in here talking about practice.
The Dave Sinclair, Lincoln, and Ford Sports Open Line continues.
Not a game. We're talking about practice.
On KMOX.
Well, certainly the name Nick Price is going to come up over and over again next week as the 100th PGA Championship comes to St. Louis and Belle Reve Country Club. And joining us is that Hall of Fame golfer, Nick Price. Nick, welcome back to KMOX.
Hey, thanks so much, Dan. Good to be with you.
Nick, just an update on where you are right now in terms of what's keeping you busy these days. I know you spent a number of years working on the President's Cup. What occupies your time most of the time now?
Well, you know, I'm semi-retired. I haven't played much. I had a really bad elbow injury, which I had to take after I had surgery and everything. It was about a year and a half I didn't play. So when I did come back, my game was really not where I wanted to be. So I played for about another year or so and then came back from the one tournament. And I just said to my wife, that's it. I think I've had enough. It's time to turn it in. So my tournament career sort of ended at the beginning of 2015. And since that time, you know, I've done, obviously, I've got a golf course design business, which keeps me busy. I joined the USGA at the beginning of this year. And now I'm on the executive committee of the USGA. So that keeps me quite busy. And then other than that, my wife and I travel a lot, and she likes to fish as I do, so you know, we go around the world and we visit friends and we have a good time. So, you know, I'm sort of like 50% of the time I'm busy, and the rest of the time I'm enjoying myself.
Well, let's reminisce a little bit. Let's take you back to 1992. And in describing that final round, you go into the final round, two shots behind Gene Sowers, playing in the second last group of the day. And if I was trying to, you know, doing the research on that final round, if I was trying to characterize that final round, I would say, well, look at what Francisco Molinari did a week ago at Carnoustie, which is you went out on the front nine, parred all the holes, and let people make their mistakes. You make the turn. I think Sowers falls by the wayside on the front nine. Jeff Maggard falls away as you continue to grind through that nine, and then you shoot one under the back nine to get rid of John Cook. Is that a fair description or comparison, that Molinari round that we just saw at Carnoustie, where he let everybody else back up?
I think that was, for me, it was an accumulation of knowledge and experience that I'd sort of had over the years in previous situations, and that in getting to the chance to have a chance to win a major championship. And the final round of a major championship is always, you know, it really isn't. I mean, obviously you have to play to a certain standard, but if you're in a chance to win, you know, a major championship, come on the last nine holes or the last round of a major, you're obviously playing well, obviously playing very well. And I just knew that it was going to be a day where the guy who made the least mistakes out there was going to win. And that's what I was intent on trying to do, was to make the least amount of mistakes, you know, try and pick my way around the course without having any disasters, without, you know, obviously making any double or triple bogeys. And I did that. And the front nine, I played flawlessly. I hit a lot of good iron shots. I drove the ball very well the whole week. And so I just didn't take any chances. And, you know, the golf course was not conducive to low scoring that week. I think 6-1. And, you know, it wasn't about how many birdies you were going to make. It was really about how many bogeys you weren't going to make.
And I'll take you back to literally the night before, because you were very generous with your time with me Saturday night in the locker room after the third round. And the two things that I remember about the conversation we had was, the first thing, I came away from that conversation knowing that Nick Price really was confident that he was going to go out and win the next day. You were confident that week. In fact, I believe early in the week, David Ledbetter said something about the course sets up well for Faldo, and you shot back, yeah, but it sets up well for me as well. Talk about your confidence.
Well, you know, I think all the stars were aligned that week for me. You know, having played well in 1991 and having such a good year, and then 92 playing really well up until that PGA. Everything was the stars were aligned. You know, my ducks were in a row. I was playing well. My short game was in really great shape. And the golf course, it was just one of those golf courses that if you were patient and you didn't try and push too hard, you know, you were gonna do well. I felt like I was gonna do really well that week. I don't know if I ever felt like straight out I was going to win, but I knew that if I played well, I would have a chance to win, which is all you can ask for going into the start of a major championship. But it was really a culmination of a lot of things, Dan. It was the experience. It was my game was coming together, and then the patience in the end. That's what did it. I think Faldo shot like 76 or 75 on the third round. And really, I can remember asking David Ledbetter what happened, and he said he just lost patience. And so that was one of the things, you know, obviously that sort of wasn't the thing that prompted me the next day, but I knew it was all about patience on that golf course.
And the second part of that conversation, and you talk about the stars lining up, the second part of that conversation was you detailed the fact that even though through the 80s you had come within an eyelash of winning two Open Championships, you had shot 63 at the Masters, you made the decision at some point in time that you needed to take your game to a different level in order to get where you thought you could be. And you went to Ledbetter and said, what do we need to do? And you sort of built it from the ground up. Talk a little bit about the risk and the reward of that process.
Well, that was in 82 when I first went to see him, in the early part of 82. So, you know, my work with him, I always felt was what really kicked my game into gear, what really got me going. But you know, I was a very streaky player, and I could play well for, you know, 2 days out of the four, but the other 2 days I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know where I was going to hit the ball, and I just didn't have a game that I could depend on. And so that's what I really embarked on with David was to try and build a golf swing that was reliable and repetitive under pressure. And so, you know, when I first saw my swing on video, I was shocked because, you know, not like today where we see our swings on video and we can break them down where you have 10,000 frames per second and on a video or you know, an HD camera, whatever it may be. In those days, it was all video, and the video wasn't very good. I hadn't seen my swing too much on video, but it was totally different to what I thought it looked like. And so, you know, David and I, he gave me some really great things to work on, more on the playing side and of the golf swing, and just to help me to build that repetitive swing. So, you know, for me, it wasn't really an option in 82. I'd played well in Europe in 1979 and 80. Well, 78 was my first year, but 79 and 80, I'd played well. And then 1981, I had a very poor year after having had such a great year the year before. And, you know, I knew that I had to go out and do something different and had to find something that I could work on in my golf swing that would make it repeat. And, you know, it took me a long time, but, it was well worth the wait. And, you know, once I did build this golf swing and, you know, when I did play well, certainly in the 90s, I really felt like, if I putted decently, I had a chance to win just about every week I played.
Let's look at two critical holes over the closing stretch. At 16, you're paired with John Cook. As I said, Nygaard and Sowers have sort of played their way out of the picture, but Cook is very much a part of that. He chips in on 16. You respond by rolling in a 30-footer for birdie. It's not match play, but there had to be some kind of match play emotions for the two of you in that moment.
Well, you know, I was looking at the leaderboard, and I remember Faldo was playing really well. I think he had already posted a score of 281, or I think he shot 66 or 67, which was one of the lowest rounds of the week on that Sunday, and he'd already posted that score. So that was sort of the number that I think John Cook and I were looking to beat. And when we got on 16, when John chipped in, you know, I'd hit such a really good tee shot, kept it underneath the hole about 25 feet or so. And it was just one of those putts that, you know, I could give a good run without hitting it, you know, 5 or 6 feet by because it was uphill. And, you know, I just, to be honest, I can't say I was trying to make it. I was just trying to hit a really solid putt. And if it went in, it went in. And, of course, the thing went in. I hit it perfectly and it went in. So, you know, sometimes when a player that you're playing with, when he breaks the ice and makes a chip or makes a long putt, it's always good to see the ball go in the hole when you're playing, you know, stroke play. It's good to see your opponent's ball, but your playing partner's ball go in the hole because that just, I don't know, it's just one of those things that, you know, you often see a guy who shoots a really low round is playing with a guy who's also making a lot of birdies.
And then from the fairway out the par 5 17th, with water in front of the green and the two-shot lead, you go for the green. Some people would say, why not lay up?
Well, for me, it was a perfect yardage to hit the ball in the back bunker. I wasn't going to play anything, you know, mess around with that front part of the green at all. And up the left-hand side, I took it up the left-hand side of the green and basically would have had to hit a really poor second shot to have hit it in the water. But I hit a really strong, you know, second shot, with a 3-wood. And, you know, just got it past pin high and in the back bunker. And then I didn't hit a very good bunker shot, unfortunately. But the water was looking at me from the other side now. And, you know, I tried to make that first putt and ran it by. I just hit it a little too hard, ran it by about 6-8 feet. And the last thing I wanted to do after playing well, so the whole day, was to make a bogey there. But once again, I hit a really good putt and my putter saved me.
That putt, You're basically looking at a putt that guarantees something you played your whole professional life to do. I mean, you still have 18 to play, but you preserve a two-shot lead. You're pretty much knowing you're going to be the PGA champion. Do you remember what level of anxiety or nerves you had?
Wasn't thinking. I mean, obviously, you know, but walking between the greens and the tees and walking between shots, your mind does tend to wander, but you know, I think I was so disciplined at that stage, I wasn't even thinking about the ramifications if I missed that putt. I just picked my line, and if I remember correctly, it was like a right-edge putt uphill, which is, for a right-handed golfer, is just the perfect putt that you want to have. And you know, I just made that 25 foot of the hole before, so obviously I was very confident with my putter, and you know, I knocked it in. So to be honest, Dan, I honestly don't think that maybe in, you know, 10, 15 years earlier, I would have worried about what the consequences of missing that putt were. But I think at that time, I was just more intent on just putting the very best stroke I could on that putt, and then worry about whatever happened when I got to 18, you know, when I had to play 18.
You par 18, you win the championship, you do the trophy presentation, all the photos and all that afterwards. You come into the media center to visit with the press, and as you walk in, there on the stage sits Jeff Squeaky Metal and your caddy, who had been the winning caddy the year before with John Daly. And probably the only time in major championship history, a major champion has waited for his caddy to finish. Talk about what Squeaky gave to you that you didn't get from other caddies. What was unique in terms of his relationship with you?
You know, there's a sixth sense between a caddy and a player when they do really well. And, you know, you look at the successful ones over the years. I mean, the most obvious one of recent times is Phil Mickelson and Bones. They've always had this great relationship where, you know, they love to talk to each other. They like to talk loudly and let everyone know what's going on, which is great. But that's part of their whole deal. Squeak with me was just a confidence booster. He had enough confidence in my ability and would keep sort of reiterating to me, Nick, you've got the game. You've got the game. And he instilled a confidence in me that I don't think any other caddy had ever done. Plus, he understood the way I like to play golf, and the way I felt was the smartest and or the most intelligent way to attack a golf course, and also to with your strategy on the golf course. And we were very good at sticking to that strategy. We also worked on one of the things we worked really hard on was to never talk in negatives. So I'd never let him say to me, "There's water short of the green." We'd always say, There's plenty of room at the back of the green. So you would never put anything negative in there. So it wouldn't be, "Don't hit it right here." He'd say, "There's plenty of room left." So the whole way around the golf course, we were always talking in positive. And that, over the years, he perfected that. I think we both perfected that with each other. And, you know, we used to have a fine. If you said anything negative on the golf course, it'd be $10. And I don't think any money changed hands for a long, long time there. But, you know, he was an amazing fellow. He came along at the right time in my career, and as I did with him. I think, you know, he was a little older than I was, and he was sort of getting to that age where he was really looking for a player like me and to do what we did. And to be honest, that from 91 through to, you know, about 6 months before he died in 97, were probably, you know, those were the greatest days of my golf course, of my golf life. They really were. And, you know, it's hard. I miss him a lot now because as you get into the twilight years or you get a little older in your life, you want to reminisce with people and you remember things. He was the only one that was there on the bag with me during that period that, you know, we could talk about. And, of course, you forget things and then your caddy forgets things, but then you remember things and remind, you know, every time you start telling stories. But I miss him a lot. He was a great man.
And two final questions for 1992 PGA champion Nick Price. Nick, they always say after a player wins that first major, it swings the door open, and we're going to see more out of that player. And it rarely happens that the player takes it to the next level. But it happened in your case. You went on and got that Open championship that you wanted through the 80s. You won another PGA championship, a Hall of Fame career. Were you a different player when you left St. Louis, knowing that you had that major now on your resume?
Without a doubt. You know, I always say one of the things that I always lacked in my career was confidence. And confidence is that X factor. Who knows how much it makes a difference? Is it times 2, times 4, times 8? Does it multiply your game? And does it have a huge impact on your game? And that's what happened to me. I got really confident, and I felt like and I didn't want to, not in a cocky, outspoken way, but I got confident in my ability to be able to play under pressure and under the most severe pressure and to not fear anybody on a golf course. And I think the biggest thing I feared on the golf course was to make stupid mistakes. That was the biggest thing, was to not give the golf course a chance by making mistakes on it. Whether they were, most of the time those mistakes are mental, and then they compound themselves because you physically hit a bad shot when you make a mental mistake, and then that sort of, it echoes in your game after that. It just keeps coming back. So, you know, I always try to just look forward to the next shot. That's what, when I was playing really well, think about the next shot. Finish the one you're playing, you know, and then all you think about is what are you going to do with the next shot? Not the one after that or the one after that, but the next one you're going to play. So, you know, confidence was huge for me. So, that was really the start of a run in my career that, let's put it this way, I caught lightning in a bottle for a few years.
And you told me a couple of years ago that you thought that maybe you let that star burn a little too bright and it may have cost you a little production near the end of your career. I don't want to ask you about that. I want to ask you because right after you climb to the top of the mountain, Tiger comes along and does the same thing. And I'm wondering, as you're watching Tiger over the next 10 years, living the world that you had to live in for that period of time, not so much how well he played, but were you ever sort of startled that he could sustain in that kind of environment without losing stride?
Yeah, well, Tiger was totally different to me, obviously, but I was a journeyman for so many years of my career. And, you know, I dreamed of getting to play golf the way I did in the 90s. So when I got there, it was really a wonderful experience. And all of this hard work over the 12 or 13 years of my 14 years of my early part of career and all the work I'd done was now coming to fruition, and I loved it. The problem that I had is I had a tough time saying no to people, and I actually bit off more than I could chew when it came to doing the amount of interviews and doing, you know, whether coming back home here when I was supposed to be taking time off, doing more articles for some of the golf magazines or for media, whatever it may have been. So I got really, really busy in it, and it kind of wore me out there. Toward the end of 95, beginning of 96, I was, around about that time I was really worn out, and I had to take some time off from the game just to regroup. Tiger managed his time so much better than I did, and a lot of people would criticize the way that he wouldn't give interviews and sometimes he wouldn't sign autographs and that, but you know, the demands on his time were probably 50 times worse than the demands on my time. So he had to have someone help manage him through that time. Otherwise, he would never have hit a practice ball. You know, walking through those days, and it's hard. Look, he was a kid once. He wanted to sign autographs, but he knew if he stopped, you know, he was going to be there for an hour and a half signing autographs. And the same thing with all of his interviews. You know, there were only so many that he could do. So I really admired him for having the discipline, you know, to go through and to continue to do that. There were times that he did do autographs, and he did lots of autographs, and he gave, you know, lots of interviews. But they were at a time where it didn't affect his playing or his preparation to an upcoming major or championship. So, you know, it's hard, but I don't even know what it would like to have been, you know, in his shoes, because his demands on his time, as I say, were a lot worse than mine.
Nick Brice, you will forever be a champion here in St. Louis. We all enjoyed that 92 run. We wish we could get the same weather you had that year coming up a week from now. But we appreciate the time, and good luck going forward, Nick. Really enjoyed the visit on KMOX.
Hey, thanks so much, Dan, and I hope everyone has a fantastic week up there. I'm going to be watching it on TV, and I'm really looking forward. I know you guys are going to have a great champion.
All right, if you want to jump in and talk Cardinals, the phone number is 314-436-7900. The Strike Zone coming up. Charlie Marlowe from Fox 2 is going to be with me until 9 o'clock. So much Cardinals to get to after a very, very busy week. This has been the Dave Sinclair Lincoln and Ford Sports Open Line. Ben Boyd, our executive producer, Mike Anderson. Mike in the studio, and we're back talking Cardinals until 9 o'clock tonight. The Strike Zone, powered by Graybar, starts after the news on KMOX.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day.
Oh, and you want the proof?
Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.